Prabhupada very wonderfully, because he wasn't sure if he could translate the whole Chaitanya Charitamrita. So he took, I think it's five conversations from the Chaitanya Charitamrita, where Lord Chaitanya specifically giving instructions. So there's this conversation with Prakashananda, with Ramananda Roy, with Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya, with Srinathana Goswami. Five conversations. And so you get the essence of all of Lord Chaitanya's teachings in this book. It's really, really fantastic. Translation. In the forest of the material world, the conditioned soul is sometimes bitten by envious enemies, which are compared to serpents and other creatures. Through the tricks of the enemy, the conditioned soul falls from his prestigious position. Being anxious, he cannot even sleep properly. He thus becomes more and more unhappy, and he gradually loses his intelligence and consciousness. In that state, he becomes almost perpetually like a blind man who has fallen into a dark well of ignorance. So, it appears Prabhupada has taken that verse to be very obvious and is not commented. So I'll read the next verse. The conditioned soul is sometimes attracted to the little happiness derived from sense gratification. Thus he has illicit sex or steals another's property. At such a time he may be arrested by the government or chastised by the woman's husband or protector. Thus simply for a little material satisfaction, he falls into a hellish condition and is put into jail for rape, kidnapping, theft, and so forth. Purport by Srila Prabhupada. Material life is such that due to indulgence in illicit sex, gambling, intoxication, and meat-eating, the conditioned soul is always in a dangerous condition. Meat-eating and intoxication excite the senses more and more, and the conditioned soul falls victim to sex desire. In order to keep a woman, money is required, and to acquire money, one begs, borrows, or steals. Indeed, he commits abominable acts that cause him to suffer both in this life and in the next. Consequently, illicit sex must be stopped by those who are spiritually inclined and who are on the path of spiritual realization. Many devotees fall down due to illicit sex. They may steal money or even fall down from the highly honored, renounced order. Then, for a livelihood, they accept menial services and become beggars. It is therefore said in the Shastras, Yan maitunari grihamedi shukam iha tucham. Materialism is based on sex, whether licit or illicit. Sex is full of dangers, even for those who are addicted to household life. Whether one has a license for sex or not, there is great trouble. Bahu dukkha bhuk. After one indulges in sex, many volumes of miseries ensue. One suffers more and more in material life. A miserly person cannot properly utilize the wealth he has, and similarly, a materialistic person misuses the human form. Instead of using it for spiritual emancipation, he uses the body for sense gratification. Therefore, he's called a miser. Alagyan tirandasya gyananjana shalakaya chakshurun militam jena tasmai shi guruve namaha mukham karoti vachalam ongum langayate girim yatkrapa tamaham vande shi gurum dinatarinam Shri Rupa, Shri Sanatana, Bhakta Raguna, Shri Jiva Gopal Bhatta, Dasa Raguna, Shri Chaitanya Mano, Vishtam, Stapitam, Jaina Bhutale, Swayam Rupa Kada, Mayam Gadati, Swaparantikam. Namo Mahavaranyaya, Krishna Prema, Pradayate, Krishnaya Krishna Chaitanya, Namne Gaurat Vishem Namaha. Hey Krishna, Karuna, Sindhu, Dinabandhu Jagatpate Gopesha Gopika Kanta Radha Kanta Namostute Tapta Kanchana Gaurange Adhe Vrindavaneshwari Rishabhanu Sute Devi Pranamami Hari Priye He Krishna Karuna Sindhu Dinabandhu Jagatpate Gopesha Gopika Kanta Radha Kanta Namostute Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Tapasmi Radhikanata, Karmana Manasagira, Krishna Kante Tavai Vasmi, Yuvame Vagatirvama, Govinda Vallabhe Radhe Partaye Tvamaham Sadam, Tvadiyayiti Janatu, Govindo Mamtaya Sahat. Radhe Vrindavanadishe Karuna Mitavahini Kripaya Nijapada Jadasyam Mahyam Pradiyatam Tavaivasmi Tavaivasmi Najivami Twayavina Iti Vijaya Devi Tvam Nayamam Charanam Tikam Vanchakalpatarubhyascha Rupasindubhyay Vacha Patithanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha. So we continue to read about the forest of material enjoyment, and we continue to be warned of all the great dangers, potential dangers in that forest. In these two verses, we have been warned about the snakes of envious persons that bite, or the snakes compared to envious persons that bite, and the enmities that people get caught up into. How enmity, politics, creates such anxiety that one cannot even sleep at night. And one gets caught up in a cycle of conflict where one even forgets what the conflict was about to begin with. It becomes more about winning and defeating the opponent than the actual, they forget what the actual, why they were even fighting. This is compared to a dark well of ignorance. And while caught up in these affairs, which cause so much disturbance, there is some glimmer or sense of happiness that can be achieved through sex. Or sometimes we might have a sense that we will get happiness by coveting the property of another, that we might steal. And this creates further trouble, further problems. So, Bhagavatam is painting a very black picture here of material existence. Quarrel, lust, greed, and punishment, great suffering. Fear and greed, these are the two primary factors that motivate people in human society. People are motivated by fear, they are motivated by greed. Fear makes us run away from things, from people, from situations, or holds us back from opening ourselves up to other people or situations. Greed makes us run towards them without even thinking about the consequences. Greed causes us to act in ways that don't make sense. As Arjuna himself says, lust, greed, sometimes make us act in a way that we even know we shouldn't be, but we do it anyway. So these are the lust and or fear and greed. They are the essence of our conditioned nature. A negative psychology or sociology might say that that is the essence of human nature. But the Bhagavatam or the Bhagavad Gita would not agree. This is rather the essence of our conditioned nature, our essential nature. Is of love and service. Our essential nature is love and service, but our conditioned nature is essentially, if you can distill it, to fear and greed. And so this creates a conflict within each person in this material world. There is a conflict between our essential nature as soul and our conditioned nature as beings that identify with a material body and a material senses and a material world as the source of happiness. Our essential nature wants to love and to serve. Our conditioned nature wants to dominate and control and oppress. Our conditioned nature wants to be served. Everyone else should be serving me. Our spiritual nature wants to love and serve. And so this conflict rages within us. And for more conditioned beings, the conflict will be less. Their essential nature is more covered. But for the more pious soul, then that conflict can be greater. There is a parable that is told by the American Indians, one of their traditional stories, that there are two wolves within us. The wolf of greed and the wolf of compassion. Yeah, American Indians, they talk about, they have a connection with wolves, and so that's the imagery that they use. Two wolves within us, a wolf of greed and a wolf of compassion. And so the question is, and they are fighting with each other. So which wolf will win? That should be the a concern. Yeah, if there are two wolves fighting within, which wolf will win? It's the wolf that you feed. Which wolf are you feeding? Are you feeding the wolf of greed, or are you feeding the wolf of compassion? Are you feeding your conditioned nature, or are you feeding your essential spiritual nature? That's which will dominate. And then you might say, well, to keep bases secure, I'm feeding both. And that's where that great conflict comes. Try to, yeah, like Vishwarup was installed as a priest for the devas. After Brihaspati was offended by Indra and left, he rejected his disciple Indra and went away from Amravati. So the devas, they were without a priest. Meanwhile, the asuras, they became very powerful. They had their priest Shukracharya, who was very pleased with Bali Maharaj's service. So the devas went to Vishnu. What do we do? Asuras are becoming more powerful. They're defeating us. We need a priest. You should approach some other brahmana to be your guru. So they approached Vishwarup, very powerful, powerful priest, very powerful brahmana. I believe he had 3 heads. Maybe. Can't remember the exact descriptions. So he would perform the hotris, he would perform the yajnas for the benefit of the devas, that they would become powerful and strong. Indra noticed our priest, he's offering oblations, we're chanting the mantras very loudly, Om Agne, you know, this one's for Agni, this one's for Vayu, this one's for... And then he's offering other oblations secretly. The ghee is going into the fire and the mantra is very quiet. And so he was curious what's going on here, and he had his... he sat very close to see what's going on, to observe exactly the movements of his priest, put him under great scrutiny, surveillance, as he was doing the yajna. And he noticed this Vishwarup, he's offering oblations both for the devas and the asuras, feeding both wolves. Vishwarup's purpose, his mother was actually an asura. His father was a rishi that, like with Ram, Sorpanaka, she changed herself into a beautiful form. Or with Bhim, Hidimbi, she changed herself into the form of a beautiful girl. So this rishi was meditating, some rakshashi, demoness, saw him and fell in love, so she transformed herself into looking like an apsara and seduced him. And the offspring was this Vishwarup, who was a great Brahmin himself, but he had split allegiances. Indra was so enraged that he took out his sword, cut off the priest's head. Very tragic. For which he was punished. lots and lots of consequences followed on from there. And that's material life. Things become very, very complicated when we act in lust or greed. Oh, what a tangled web we weave when first we practice to deceive. You tell one lie, then you have to tell another lie to make up for that lie. And then as that starts to unravel, you have to make up something else. You have to implicate other people to get them to support your lie. And it becomes a very complicated web of deception. So for the transcendentalist, or the aspiring transcendentalist who's trying to cultivate transcendence, their spiritual nature, but they still have material attachments as well, and so they might end up feeding both wolves, both natures, our spiritual nature but our material nature as well. So that is a great challenge, making that transition. It's always a challenge. And sometimes we will move to an extreme. We will take extreme positions. That is a symptom of the neophyte devotee. Vishwanath Chakrabarti Thakur describes different stages of anishta bhakti, or unsteady, unfixed devotion. Something like six stages. The first is utsaha mayi. Utsaha mayi means? False enthusiasm. False enthusiasm. Utsaha mayi. Maya's illusory. So illusory enthusiasm. Utsahan vischayadaya. Utsahan is generally favorable for bhakti. But illusion or false enthusiasm is when one thinks one is much more advanced than one actually is. Like a child, Vishwanath gives the example, like a child that goes to school for the first few days and learns the alphabets and thinks they know how to read. There is A, there is B, there is C, there is D. Oh, very well, very good. You can read books now. But that's not the purpose. The purpose is not to point out where it's A or B or C. It's actually to read words and understand meaning. But the child who learns those few alphabets, they think that now I know how to read. And so the neophyte devotee, they will learn a few spiritual terms, they will, you know, learn a few basic spiritual, and then think that they are someone very advanced, so much better than everyone else. That is called utsaha mayi. They become falsely proud. We become falsely proud of the little spiritual advancement we have made. Another stage, or described by Vishwanath, is gana tarala. Gana tarala means thick and thin. Our devotion is thick and thin. One day I'm very enthusiastic for bhakti yoga. I'm present for the kirtans. I chant japa with attention. And the next day I'm too tired, too busy, so I don't have time. Or I have different excuses. And then, so like this, I'll go through different periods. For these few weeks I'm enthusiastic. For those many weeks I'm not. And then I get into it again, and so our bhakti is thick and thin. Vishwanath then describes Vyudhavikalpa. Vyudhavikalpa means, can anyone say? Speculating. Think I should become a sannyasi. I'm going to focus on staying celibate, renounced throughout my entire life. And so that becomes a goal for a few days. And then, maybe my nature is more towards householder life. There are so many nice matajis or prabhus. Somebody should, you know, it's also a great service to care for another person. We can help each other in Krishna consciousness. And so, Prahlad Maharaj, Bhishma Dev, Ambarish Maharaj, Advaita Acharya, Nityananda Prabhu, they were all grihasthas. It's possible to be a very advanced devotee and a grihastha as well, a householder as well. So then you think like that for a few days, and then you might see some grihastha couple having some quarrel. Oh, I'm definitely never going to be a grihastha. So much trouble. So happy that I'm a brahmachari, going on to become a sannyasi. And so you're like this, just speculating. After that, you might decide, enough with the speculation. Niyamakshama. From now on, I'm going to be a very resolute, purposeful, focused devotee. I will wake up at 2:30 a.m. each day. I will have a cold shower. I will chant 16 rounds before Mangalartik. After Mangalartik, I'm going to read Bhagavatam for 2 hours. And on Ekadasis, I'm going to do a full fast, nirjal, without water. And so you become very determined, possibly quite aggressive in your determination to be an advanced devotee. Niyamakshama, taking resolute vows. And after some time, you might become famous as a devotee. Prabhu knows so much, they can chant so many verses. So dedicated, doing so much service for an extended period of time, they're worthy of our honor and respect. They're like our guru. And initially, the devotee might refuse that respect and adoration, the privileges, the honor that is offered. But in time, they might come to think, actually, this is true, this is correct. I am the most advanced devotee here. I am the most knowledgeable and realized. And honor should be offered to me. And in fact, why did they not offer me a garland at the beginning of the... whatever, yeah? And so, you might... maybe you're going to visit some other devotees. You'll send a list beforehand. This is my diet. Breakfast, I need 5 types of fruit and yogurt. And for lunch, these preparations have to be there according to my Ayurvedic doctor. And so on and so forth. You become very much concerned about the honor and respect and facility that you demand. So this is called Taranga Rangini. Taranga Rangini means riding the waves of honor, of prestige, in that honor that it comes to you through bhakti. Because bhakti is most attractive, because bhakti is beautiful, because bhakti is the most valuable thing that there is in this world. And so when a devotee cultivates that for a period of time, they themselves become attractive and beautiful and honorable. But this can be Maya's last snare, yeah? You take to a path of devotion, wanting to feed our spiritual nature and starve our conditioned nature. But then that conditioning comes in and covers over our bhakti. Maya finds a way to get in and bewilder the devotee. And so once you start to demand respect and honor and prestige and position, then you start to quarrel like the materialist. We've heard about the snake bites, yeah? So you start to bite and be bitten and become anxious because of politics and unable to sleep. And you might covet the possessions of others because that respect and privilege is not being given to you, that facility is not being given, you might think it is in your right to steal it. And again, we become distracted from the path, from the pure path of devotion, while thinking that we are feeding a heart of devotion, we are instead feeding a heart of pride and greed, of fear and greed. Rather than nurturing love and devotion, we nurture fear and greed. Mm. don't want everyone to feel depressed and demoralized. Vishwanath points these things out so we can be attentive. To go from anishta or unsteady devotion to nishta bhakti, fixed devotion. We know the stages of devotion. It begins with shraddha, with faith. It is cultivated through sadhusanga, through association with Vaishnavas, through association with people, practitioners of bhakti. And it is nurtured through practices of bhajan, bhajana kriya, practices of chanting, kirtan, practices of hearing, kirtan, hearing Srimad Bhagavatam, practices of remembering Krishna. And as we engage in these practices, in the association of devotees, our faith deepens. And it becomes, it goes from the anishta or unsteady to nishta bhakti, fixed devotion. And that's a madhyama adhikari. A madhyama adhikari is one who has fixed devotion. The kanishta or the neophyte bhakti yogi is one whose devotion is unsteady, is unfixed. It can be swayed. It can be swayed by our conditioned nature, the distractions that arise. It can be swayed by other arguments which cause doubts to appear. The Madhyama Adhikari, or the advanced devotee, is not swayed. Their devotion is fixed. It is rooted very deeply in practice, in realization. So even a big storm comes, the tree remains. The tree, the creeper of devotion remains rooted. It remains steady. And as we cultivate nishta bhakti, that is when actual taste arises, ruchi arises. That is when bhava, experiences of deep spiritual emotion, arise in the heart. That deep spiritual emotion which cannot be checked, it manifests simply, externally, as hair standing on end. It manifests externally as tears welling in the eyes. It manifests shivering in the body when we say the holy names, when we hear the holy name. These ecstatic transformations of the body manifest. That is very advanced, not to be imitated or put on for a show. Then again, we are feeding fear and greed. When we try to supersede the process of cultivation and jump to the point of ecstasy. Although in the beginning that ecstasy might also be experienced. Generally, those are the symptoms of very advanced practitioners. Finally, from bhava, then prema. At the level of bhava, one is able to see within one's heart the Lord and his pastimes. At prema, then the devotee enters into those pastimes. So, which nature are we cultivating? Which nature are we facilitating? Which nature are we feeding? We should be conscious and aware of that. It's very simple. Bhakti yoga is very simple. You have your conditioned nature, you have your spiritual nature. And so, the process of bhakti yoga is you feed your spiritual nature, you cultivate your spiritual nature. Now, I said it's very simple, but for people who are in between, that can be more complex, because we might find it difficult to distinguish which is my material nature, which is my spiritual nature. Should I leave work? Should I leave my family? Should I leave Sydney, go and live in a forest somewhere and be spiritual? That is a neophyte conclusion of what it means to nurture our spiritual nature. Cultivate your spiritual nature at whatever position you are at now, wherever you are now, whatever your situation now, whatever your qualification now, from that point, you cultivate your spiritual nature. And cultivating the spiritual nature doesn't mean leaving things behind, but seeing how those things are connected to Krishna, how they come from Krishna, how they belong to, how they are the energy of the Lord. So if we think that we are, that leaving them behind, that means we're leaving the material, no, that means that we're leaving the material world behind, no. It means that we have material consciousness, and that's actually the problem. If we think that leaving our job or our family or our whatever situation we are in, if that leaving that is spiritual because those things are all material, it means we have material consciousness. A transcendentalist has spiritual consciousness, and they're able to see Krishna. They're able to see Krishna's divine nature in everything. Everything can be made as an offering to the Lord. Bhagavad Gita was spoken on a battlefield. On a battlefield, which is the most trying situation that a human being can be subjected to. You're on a front line opposing people, or opposed by people with weapons that are trying to kill you. Can you think of any more difficult situation than that? We might say the epitome of the material conditioned situation is the front line of a battlefield. The lust and the greed and the fear have come to the point where people are standing opposing each other, trying to kill one another. And Arjuna is being told by Krishna, you can be a transcendentalist here. How's that? We might give excuses. Oh, I can't be a dedicated practitioner of bhakti yoga because I have my family situation. I have my work. I'm not free to be fully dedicated to Krishna here. We might give our excuses. Well, are you in such a difficult situation as Arjuna was? On the front line of a battlefield? Whatever excuse we can give cannot equal Arjuna's situation. Unless you yourself are on the front line of a battlefield as well. You might think that your home situation is like a battlefield. Whatever excuse you can give, it cannot equal Arjuna's excuse. Arjuna is saying, I can't be spiritual here on a battlefield, I have to go to the forest. And Krishna is saying, no, figure out how to do it here. You can do it here. And that's for us. Krishna is telling us, you can be spiritual here, wherever you are. No excuses. By cultivating spiritual consciousness, you can be spiritual here and now. Not tomorrow, sometime in the future, when things are more settled, when I've finished my degree, or when I've got my car, or when I'm closer, moved house and I'm closer, and I can be more spiritual. None of that. You can feed and nurture your spiritual nature anywhere. That's the message, the essential message of the Bhagavad Gita. And if you think you have to run away somewhere else to do it, it means you won't do it there either. You'll carry the same consciousness with you. In Bengali, there's a proverb, apparently, I don't know the Bengali, that a sickle, whether it is on earth or in heaven, it has the same duty to cut grass. How do you say that? There you go. The sickle on earth or in heaven, it cuts grass. And so your consciousness, whether it is in earth or in heaven, it's the same consciousness. If it's material, it will see and experience it as material. If it is spiritual consciousness, then you will experience that environment as spiritual. So what consciousness are you nurturing? What consciousness are you feeding? We need to make the transition. After so many lifetimes of nurturing material consciousness, we need to transition over to nurturing spiritual consciousness. Our higher spiritual nature, to go from anishta bhakti to nishta bhakti. Otherwise we remain in the material whirlpool where we are bitten by snakes, caught up in conflict and enmities, become overwhelmed by lust and greed and become punished as a result of that. But how long do we want to keep doing that? Bhagavad Gita says we've been doing it for countless lifetimes. So time to stop that and awaken our spiritual nature, our loving nature, our devotional nature, our soul, our essential nature is to love and to serve. So we'll conclude. Are there any comments or questions? Yes, Prabhu.
So, regarding this material consciousness, you said you carry.
Yeah.
But where's the fine line where we have to create some favorable situations to do better bhakti? If we just keep thinking, no, I have to do it better here, all of the situations apparently may be sort of reverse against your bhakti. So where's that line where we are mature enough to take a decision, no, I have to leave it to nurture better bhakti, or keep struggling the situation and try to make us more especially advanced?
A good question. The question is that I've been saying that that we can be spiritual anywhere, and that we might think we have to run away from somewhere to be spiritual somewhere else. The question is, where's the line? Because between continuing in a situation and trying to make that spiritual, or making adjustments, to put ourselves in an environment that can nurture our spirituality. Because definitely environment does have an impact on our consciousness. Okay. Here's the thing. That your point is valid. Environment does have an effect on our consciousness. Our instruction is to, in whatever situation we're in, to create a spiritual environment. So the home is an example. Bhaktivinoda Thakur says how he saw the home as Vaikuntha. He saw his home as the spiritual world. He created that environment within the home. So rather than needing to run away to an ashram, his home was the spiritual world. There is the altar, there are spiritual sounds being played, there are images that remind one of the Lord. Family members are honored as servants of the Lord. And so as much as possible, in whatever situation we are in, we try to make that as a favorable situation. That's spiritual consciousness. Rather than thinking we have to run away from somewhere to be somewhere else, and then I can be spiritual. Real spiritual strength is that you will transform your environment. Rather than being influenced by your association, you will give pure association to those around you. Rather than being locked into their hostilities, you will give love. And they will respond with love. That's the basic, essential response to your question. Sometimes in order to develop that strength in ourselves, we might spend some time in an ashram as an example, or on a spiritual retreat, or we'll go for a pilgrimage to recharge our spiritual batteries, so to speak, to get a boost of spiritual energy. To nurture that consciousness, we might spend a few days. Ekadasi is an example of very focused, attentive spiritual practice to charge our spiritual consciousness, that we can remain conscious even in an apparently hostile environment. Yeah? So that is recommended. Now, going further into your question, Krishna's instruction to Arjuna not to leave the battlefield is because he knows that Arjuna, he could go and stay in an ashram, maybe for a short period, but could he live there for an extended period? Krishna believes not. If Arjuna were to give everything up, renounce his titles and positions and responsibility, and go and live in an ashram, Krishna is of the view that Arjuna would not be able to maintain it. And that would be a fall down. You go to the Prabhupada talks about it in the purport. You go, renounce everything, you sever all your ties, you assume other responsibilities as someone in the renounced order. And that affords a certain respect in society as well. Then you can't maintain it. And that becomes scandalous. That means that you shouldn't be there. So Krishna is of the view that Arjuna wouldn't be able to maintain it in a lifelong vow of renunciation. Therefore, he's saying, you need to stay here. This is this is the situation that you're suited to in terms of consciousness, in terms of nature. So you need to make this environment spiritual. Even it's a battlefield, you need to connect it to me, to make it as an offering to me. If Arjuna was somebody who could renounce and remain in the ashram for the end of his days, Krishna might have encouraged him. Yeah, that's appropriate for you, Arjuna. But Arjuna is this masculine, you know, alpha male, virile personality. And that's not a, yeah, being this alpha male, virile, kshatriya person, that's not a, someone might think, oh, that he can't be spiritual. How can this alpha, yeah? Can't be spiritual. No, you can. You can be spiritual in that place as a ruler. But not in the ashram. So, is that clear? Yeah? Yes?
You were explaining about like we should serve, we should love. That's our spiritual life. On the other hand, like we are being affected by material conditions. Like sometimes we are in mode of goodness, sometimes we are in passion, sometimes we are in ignorance. How to keep that consistent? Sometimes you want to serve and sometimes you get like agitated or something.
How to be consistent?
Like, how you can always be in that mood, like, okay, you want to serve and you want to, like, basically love someone or love Krishna or anything.
Yeah.
We are always being affected by material, more
yeah.
of natures.
Yeah, that's the conflict that's in us. That's the conflict between our lower nature and our higher nature. So our conditioned nature doesn't want to serve, it wants to be served. Our conditioned nature doesn't love, but is rather greedy and aggressive and lusty. That's the nature that, you know, Freud speaks of. The essential being is, as you know, sexual and aggressive urges that the social consciousness is repressing, that is bubbling up inside us. So that's the conflict between our spiritual nature and our lower nature. So how to be consistent? Through practice. Through sadhana. Chanting nurtures your higher nature. Hearing nurtures your higher nature. Serving the deity, serving devotees, serving others will nurture your higher nature, and by practice you'll become more and more consistent. Your higher nature will dominate and your lower nature will be starved. It will shrivel up. Unless it figures out some more insidious way to disguise itself as putana. Yeah? Someone else? Last call here.
You talk about different stages of bhakti when we have started to see. Is it necessary to cross all those six stages within anistha to nistha and then move to the next stage, or it's like a continual process? We keep getting rid of these weeds while we move into ruchi or mala.
Yeah, okay. So the question is about the stages of bhakti. Shraddha, sadhusanga, bhajana kriya, nishtha, ruchi, and so forth. And the question is, do you need to overcome all the stages of anishtha or unsteady devotion in order to become steady? Yeah. These stages, they work in mini cycles, micro cycles, and so. How to explain that. Between Shraddha and Sadhusanga, there is Shraddha, sadhu sangha, bhajana kriya, that will shraddha sadhu sangha between those two, yeah, between shraddha sadhu sangha bhajana kriya, then those they become cycles of cycles. Does that make sense? No. Yes.
I can explain that. Every stage is connected to the previous stage. If there is no shraddha, the next stage is not come.
Yeah.
Then we go to the anatta divinity, so you have to remove the unwanted things from our heart, then only the next stage will come. So everything is connected there. So you cannot jump from one stage to another.
Yeah, that is certain. But I'm also saying that they work in microcycles as well. So we have the larger cycle, but then there are cycles within cycles of the same principles.
More permutations and
combinations. Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
More varieties going forward. Just
yeah. So, let us say between Nishta and Ruchi, there is Shraddha that needs to be deepened. There's the same point you're making. There's shraddha, there's sarusanga that needs to be engaged. So the cycle works as a microcycle as well. Thank you. All right, thank you all very much. Grantara Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai Samaveta Bhagavatam Ki Jai Nitai Gaur Prithman.
Yes.